The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Laura Miller's new work, The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia, is, as Jonathan Lethem writes, both a subtle reader's memoir and a manifesto. In her reassessment of the lost literary pleasures of childhood and her first encounters with C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, she delves into the question of why we read and the separation from the world we belong to before language. Laura first encountered Narnia some 40 years ago when a second grade teacher handed her a copy of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and she imagined at the time that she must reach Narnia or die trying. I love that. In Recapturing Narnia, Miller reveals how the books we loved as children can continue to expand and inform our imaginations. Laura Miller is co-founder of Salon.com, where she is currently a staff writer, and she's a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Los Angeles Times, Time Magazine, and other publications. Laura Miller is one of the best arts writers working today. She balances critical intelligence with a deep love of books and a deep sympathy for writers. And I can say the same of David L. Ulan, book editor for the Los Angeles Times and author of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith, who will be interviewing Laura Miller tonight. Please join me in welcoming Laura Miller and David L. Ulan. Thank you.
So we're going to talk for about 45, 50 minutes or so, and then we're going to turn it over to some questions from all of you. This is fun because I do this, but I don't usually get to interview my friends, so I'm kind of excited. So I'm going to start we'll just plunge right in. I want to start, this is a really interesting book. I mean, it's interesting for a variety of reasons, but it's interesting in terms of its kind of shape and focus. It's part criticism, part memoir to an extent. It's got a memoir component, part biography, part literary history. How did you develop that form? Did you think about, was that a conscious development process, or was that just kind of organic to the writing?
Well, over the past few years, writing book reviews and critical essays and that sort of thing, and thinking a lot about criticism, I've been for a while feeling that there was something lacking in a lot of the criticism that I'd read, which was there was no attempt to sort of address the experience of reading. And I became more and more interested in criticism that was about the reading experience. Sometimes it can be just a really subtle thing, but there is always this tendency in reviewing and criticism towards, and I would say this is, you know, particularly in America, towards a kind of display of erudition or a focus on writers and deciding how great they are and you know, this elaborate hierarchy, placing everything in the hierarchy, and a lot of things that just didn't feel that important to me. And there wasn't much that addressed sort of the life, the reading life. So I've always been interested in that, or I've long been interested in that. And then I was also wanting to find a way to write about these books, because I felt that although they had been so important to me as a child, and then when I finally did return to them as an adult, they were still really meaningful. I had never really read a work of criticism about them, or a work of scholarship about them, that that didn't focus primarily on their religious significance, and that aspect of them just doesn't mean that much to me. So I had never really read, you know, even though there's a lot written about Lewis, I had never really read anything that really dealt with my own response or addressed it in any way. So this seemed like the perfect occasion for those two things to come together. I wanted to talk about how the books that are really important to you change your identity or shape who you are. And so, and it turned out that Lewis did this, which I didn't even know when I started working on this. He wrote a book called An Experiment in Criticism, where one of the things that he suggests is that we judge a book not just by how it's written, but by how people read it. And if people read a book in a certain way, if they read it more than once, if they would notice if anyone changed a word in it, you know, he has this list of descriptions of what, of how, of a certain way that books are read, and he suggests, well, if a book is read in this way, then maybe that's how we know that it's literary, rather than by looking at how
right.
It's
I mean,
written.
He has this definition. This is really interesting. I thought it was a fascinating part of this book. He has this definition of the literary reader as opposed to the literary writer.
Yeah, and I thought that was, and he's not usually a critic who, I mean, he's a wonderful, wonderful critic, but he's not a critic who, as a general rule, you think that he has these kind of ideas that kind of make you go, wow, you know? I mean, I'd never thought of it that way before. But that was one of his moments of where he just really is surprising. And so, you know, the further I kind of went into this, the more the two things seemed to really mesh together really well. He was really interested in the relationship between the reader and the book, and I was, and these particular books, because I read them so young, because of the kind of books they are, were such a shaping influence on me, and I'm not really a kind of a fond, nostalgic sort of person, you know, like I didn't want to write one of those kind of really sentimental books about children's books, or to talk about innocence in an unambivalent way. It was also an interesting challenge to sort of write about a work of children's literature in a more adult way.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because what those two parallels, or those two threads, come back to is the experience of reading as a child, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that, you know, how a book is read as opposed to how it's written. I mean, children read in a very specific and I think kind of unfiltered way, which you write about. And also this notion that it's adult critics and largely Christian or anti-Christian critics who focus on the Christianity in the book. For kids, when I read those books at the age of 8, 9, 10, I was completely unaware of any of the Christian symbology.
Yeah, I've yet to really meet anyone who read them as a child who was able to detect this on their own, unless they were a fairly older child. I mean, most of the people that I've talked to had no idea, or if they had an idea that there was this religious meaning, it was because an adult told them there was. So that was also really interesting, you know, and people would often say, oh, you know, I can't believe I didn't notice that. And I thought, well, you know, maybe you were noticing something else much more. You know, maybe it's not just a question of you being a dumb kid. Maybe in another way, only noticing that is a way of being a dumb adult.
Right. And also you have the literal, I mean, kids are literalists, so you have there's this great little moment where you say, you know, Jesus is a guy in sandals with a beard, right?
Yeah.
Jesus isn't a lion.
Yeah.
And there's no sense I don't want to say they're not sophisticated, but they don't read the symbology.
Have the same body of experience. They haven't had enough experiences with different types of stories to recognize a pattern, an underlying a recurring pattern. They don't see the forest for the trees, but the problem with that, with being able to see the forest in spite of the trees, is that sometimes you can't even see the trees because you're so busy looking for the forest. And that's its own kind of blindness. And it's so hard for us to remember what it was like to see mostly the surface of things. as opposed to looking for the structures underneath, and that means that sometimes we miss things on the surface. And one of the ongoing themes in this book are twins, a boy and a girl, of some friends of mine who I've been very close to, and the conversations that I've had with them about things and my encounters with their way of seeing the world, because we don't even really remember how we used to think as children, and sometimes only through knowing children do we, can we be reminded of that? You know, like how frightened one of these children is by scary things and stories is continually surprising me. And much as I want to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to her, I know that she's not going to be able to take it.
Right.
the whole thing is just going to be too overwhelming for her. And at this point, and it reminded me of this thing that I had completely forgotten about, how I was afraid of monsters as a child, and how I kind of convinced myself not to be afraid of them, the various pathways that I took to doing that, and I had just completely forgotten that. You know, it just never would have occurred to me that certain things, like if you just say, and then a giant came, that would be so scary. You know, she, if you're telling her that story, she runs out of the room. Like, right. She can't even be in the same room with you when
and
you're telling that
one
story.
One of them, I can't remember if it's her or her brother, actually, there's an anecdote in the book where the child physically hides.
Yeah. His sister will run out of the room, and then because she wants to know the rest of the story, she'll, like, look around the corner of a door to sort of see if maybe you're still telling it, or maybe it's gotten better. Or sometimes she'll just say, no giants. No giants, no wolves. But her brother, who is braver, I would say, and more able to say, oh, well, that's just pretend. I was reading the story of a retelling of Androcles and the Lion, and when this boy in the story is walking around the corner of this road, he sees like the little tail of this lion coming around the corner. He went to the end of the sofa and he took like a big cushion and put it between himself and the book because, he was just like, oh, here comes the lion.
Now this is interesting because it not only gets at the way that children perceive things, but also at how children read or how we read as children and the difference. I mean, one of the things that you explore at fair length in the beginning of the book is the idea of the kind of freedom and discovery of reading without a plan or reading without a context, let's say. You know, when you discover a book as a kid, if you're a bookish kid, you're discovering that book. You're not saying, oh, before I read Faulkner, I better read Joyce. Uh-huh, yes. Well, not that you would say that as a kid, very precocious kid, maybe.
Yeah, that there is this way that how a particular book is placed in the world of literature can kind of overwhelm the actual experience of reading it, so that you're reading this novel because it's the hot novel of the year, or you're reading, like I recently read Don Quixote, which was great, but I read it partly because it was like I'd never read Don Quixote, and I really needed to know what this was. It was such a major thing, so there was this kind of dutiful quality to it. And then there are all these people who are so embarrassed that they haven't read this book or that book, and there are all these extraneous things that interfere with the actual experience, and you don't have that as much as a kid, but still you do have it some, because I can remember the whole some definite issues around three books, Heidi, Little Women, and Elsie Dinsmore, which were all books that women in my family, whether my mother or my mother's female relatives or my grandmother. My grandmother was a fan of Elsie Dinsmore, which is just, oh, it's the worst. And I hated that book as a child. And that was my first experience with being given a book that I was supposed to like, and just really disliking it. And actually, my grandmother liked that book. My mother, it was also the first experience I had with the expression goody two-shoes. Because I remember my mother saying to me, oh, she's just such a goody two-shoes, and thinking, you know, there was a word for it, you know. But so, you know, even as a kid, you get these books, and those were all three books that I didn't really like very much, but were urged upon me by people. And weirdly enough, my father, who was a big reader, I can't remember him ever pushing a book on me, but I don't know if he had particularly strong attachments to any children's books. But I felt, you know, like I definitely, the Little Women thing, I was not a fan of that book, and it felt like everyone was always telling me how great it was. So you do get that when you're a kid, a little bit.
But I mean, but The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was urged on you also by a teacher, but it's a different process.
Yes, it was given to me. It wasn't, you know, my teacher, Willanne Belden, a very, very talented teacher.
To whom you dedicate the book.
Yes, the book is dedicated to her. She was, you know, I interviewed her for this book, and I had always sort of wanted to ask her why she'd given me this book. It wasn't part of a school project or anything. She just gave it to me privately. And she was a teacher. She was the kind of teacher that I was particularly prone to attaching myself to. A lot of the other students were afraid of her. For some reason, I've always liked that kind of teacher. And she, you know, and I felt like I had some special connection with her. It's hard to really recall if that feeling of the special connection preceded her giving me the book or whether it was the result of her giving me the book. It's hard for me to say, and I don't want to be inaccurate about that. But she just sort of said, you know, you might like this. Like it was. She didn't give it to me and say, oh, I love this book as a child. Oh, this is so great. She said, you might like this. And then when I brought it back to her, and I was kind of, you know, dumbstruck by how great it was, and I could barely talk to her about it. She didn't push it. You know, she asked me a few questions, and then she said, you know, you didn't really want to talk about it. And I thought, probably you thought that if you talked about it, someone could take it away from you. And so I didn't ask you any more about it. But, you know, she kind of turned me on to the fact that there were more where that came from and that kind of thing. So it was a different experience because it wasn't given to me with the, I love this, you have to like this. I mean, for me, I think also the sort of the whole incredible merging of all those sisters with the mother and Little Women, and then the fact that this book was being kind of urged on me by my female relatives, definitely the two things were linked in my mind.
Like, but it was a way of kind of
it was
sucking
oppressive.
You into the family.
It was oppressive. But, yeah. And my temperament didn't run in that direction. I wanted this kind of outward-looking, adventurous, kind of going-forth sort of story, not this sort of inward-focusing family story. And the fact that this was, like, I was supposed to like this because people in my family liked it was, you know, there was a resistance to that, and then because teachers often represent your first encounters with the sort of outside world and the first promise that you have of, you know, that you might be an adult or that somebody is thinking about you as like a person out in the world, the fact that this book was given to me by a teacher, I think, was significant, you know, because that was like one of the first attachments I formed to someone who had no real connection with my parents.
Right, and I think that gets at one of the interesting tensions because you have, I mean, you talk about how what drew you to the book as a kid, or the books as a kid, the series, the Chronicles as a kid, was a sense of adventure, but that on reading them as an adult, one of the things that struck you was the utter absence and even irrelevance of parents.
Well, and that was one of the things that really struck me about the movie of the first film while I was sort of watching it. On DVD, you know, taking notes, and it was kind of scary because it showed, you know, I probably read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you know, 20 times or something like that, and to the point where I don't have it memorized, but I know that book really well. And I was watching this film and noticing how often the word family or the idea of family was mentioned in the movie. And the characters would say things like, you know, you're a family, you should act like one, or I want to save my family, or I have to get back to my family. And this is partly because it's produced by this evangelical production company, and that's what they're sort of pushing, is this American evangelical idea of how important the family is. But it's actually not a theme in the book at all. And I remember watching it and thinking, God, everyone's talking about families all the time. And I remember thinking, you know, if I remember correctly, the word family only appears in Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe once in connection with the giant rumble buffin, you know, something that Mr. Tumnus says about the giant rumble buffin coming from a good family. So it doesn't even have it's just like, it's more of like a heritage sort of thing. And because you can search the entire text on Amazon, because the book is, the publisher permits that, I was able to check this, and that was absolutely true, that's the only time that word appears in the book. So that gives you a sense of, you know, the degree to which, you know, family is important because those siblings are completely bonded, and the really bad thing that that Edmund does is betray his brothers and sisters. But it's almost as if in the American film version, where it speaks for a society that feels that the family is very vulnerable and needs to be reinforced, where in the, for Lewis, I think he just took for granted sibling relationships.
Right.
Because his brother, you know, he lived with his brother
his whole life,
yeah,
basically. Although he had an atrocious relationship with his father. Maybe atrocious is the wrong word.
He had a very difficult relationship with his father. His father was a difficult man, and Lewis was, you know, a difficult man in his own way. His father was a smothering person, and so I think that one of the reasons why there isn't, except in The Magician's Nephew, there isn't a lot of focus on parent-child relationships is because he was ambivalent about them. His mother died when he was 9, so he lost that relationship. And rather than sort of process that, I mean, some writers would process that loss through all of their work. He just basically sort of set it aside. And it's really remarkable that the Pevensey children in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, they go to Narnia, they get there. They're initially troubled that they're in a kind of a dangerous situation because Mr. Tumnus has been carried off by the secret police, but they decide they really need to help him. Even Susan says, yeah, we have to do this. And then after that, they never look back. I mean, people talk about how the book begins with this sort of trauma of them being sent out to the countryside from the city because of the Blitz, but they never talk about their parents. They never talk about missing their parents. And then you realize that they spend decades in Narnia. I mean, they grow up and become adults without ever wanting to go back and see their parents. They only wind up going back by accident.
Right.
So you think, well, you know, this is really, you know, if it was so hard for them to be separated from their parents at the beginning of the book, how come they never give them a second thought after that?
Right. But this speaks to that appeal of kind of the idea of a child, of yourself, or a child finding a territory of their own.
Yeah.
You know, whether a real physical territory or the idea of the emotional territory with a teacher, but also this kind of emotional space. And that has to do with both privacy and, I think, development of identity in some ways.
Yeah, I think that I mean, in my particular situation, I came from a really big family, and so the privacy was really important, and that was one of the reasons why probably I didn't necessarily want to talk about it too much with my teacher. It was good to know that she kind of gave her blessing to it. And
she
then
got it, right?
She got it,
yeah.
You know, and she gave it to me, and so there was like a kind of a benevolent presiding presence. I mean, she was very Aslan-like in that, you know, she doesn't intervene too much. She actually intervenes less than Aslan does. But but you know, she kind of set the whole thing in motion. So there was some safety of sort of adult, you know, oversight. But it was like a thing that I could pursue independently, and I didn't really share with any other children. I had, you know, two brothers and two sisters, and I, you know, I realized as I sat down to write this that I couldn't remember if I had ever really talked to them about this. You know, if they read, we never talked about the books. I didn't have friends that I shared them with.
Did they know that it was a that it was a sort of obsession of yours?
Yeah, I think everyone in my family knew that. yeah. But you know, it was one of those things, you know, that it was just like, sometimes when you're in a big family, there is that tendency to say, oh, well, that's, you know, like, Chris is really into G.I. Joe, and Laura's really into Narnia, and in a certain way, things are sort of parceled out. You know, a lot of people don't realize that growing up in a big family is not very much like the Brady Bunch. It's mostly about you trying to sort of carve out a little space for yourself and not so much about reveling in how much company you have. So that it was really important to me that this was my little world that I had all to myself, and I didn't even necessarily want to share it with my friends.
Right. Now, I want to ask you about the rereading question, because I read, like I said, I read these books around the same age you did. I loved them. I never read them again. I always remembered them or thought of them fondly, but I didn't remember anything that happened in them, so much so to the point that when I finally read them 30-some years later to my kids, it was like I was reading them anew.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I think the only thing I remembered was them going, a little bit about Aslan and them going through the back of the wardrobe. So, and I'm not a rereader by any, I mean, I reread some books, but I tend not to reread. I'm wondering, are you generally a rereader by nature? And what was the was it simply that you finished this series and then just couldn't be apart from it and went right back into it? Was it kind of a natural evolution?
As a child.
It's a two-part, it's a sort of, what's your adult experience of rereading? But let's start with your child experience of this.
Well, you know, I thought this is so peculiar to me, but actually, of course, in time, I came to realize that it's incredibly common, that they just were so good. I just, you know, nothing else was quite that amazing. And when I interviewed the writer Neil Gaiman, he basically said, well, of course I read other books because there were only 7 Narnia books.
Right.
You know, and how many times could you reread those? And to a certain extent, all, like, as I moved beyond that, I was looking for Narnia-ish books to read. And, you know, I found them, and although it was really difficult, you know, it kind of developed sort of the book hunting bibliophile instincts by trying to sort of say, okay, well, the books that are like this, how could I find them? Like, they have covers like this, they have titles like this, how would I know how to find them? And I probably asked some adults, but a lot of it was like a kind of an independent thing of finding more. But you know, one of the other people I quote in the book is a guy named Francis Spufford, who wrote a book called The Child That Books Built, and he had this similar kind of an almost frighteningly intense glomming onto Narnia thing, where he felt like these books, and this has actually turned out to be really common when I, you know, once you're writing, Narnia is not something you talk to other people about a lot as an adult. But since I was writing this book, you know, people would say, it felt like I already knew these stories. Like, I already knew this. This was something that was already in me, and somehow it was just appearing in this book. And although it's hard for me to remember the exact first experience of reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, what I said to my teacher was that I didn't know that anyone else had an imagination like mine. So I saw myself in them, or I saw some inside part of myself that I could never have put outside of myself, and yet somebody had. And I remember Neil said, he also thought they were true. He had no doubt that these were real things that had happened somewhere. Right. These were reports from a real place. I think that was a factor of us having read them young enough, because right. people who read them the first time when they were like 9 or 10 kind of knew already that they couldn't kid themselves that this might be true. So the fact that it was so personal, you know, I mean, this was like the interior of myself.
Well, and you sort of fell into the world, right? Yeah. I mean, it was as if you were not reading a report so much as going somewhere.
Yeah. And I think I've since then I've been attracted to books that have that immersive quality. Mm-hmm. There's something weirdly open-ended about the Narnia books where you can, even though it's not this totally worked out intricate thing like Middle Earth, there's just something kind of easy about them that they kind of slip into kind of a kind of an ongoing expansive world of storytelling, so that you always feel that there's more there. Like you could go there and then you would have your own adventures, you know, that was constantly kind of unfolding there. It was the world of story is really what it was. And so somehow, even though you're reading the same book over and over again, it didn't feel like, you know, this story that goes in this certain way, which I remember, that's how I felt about Heidi, even though I can't remember, you know, I like that more than, definitely more than Elsie Dinsmore, more than Little Women, but there was something, there was this kind of weird inevitability about everything that happened in Heidi, where it was like, now she's going to sleepwalk, and now she's going to drink the goat's milk, and I was just like, you know. I obviously read it more than once. Right. So, you know, whereas with Narnia, it just felt there was kind of a looseness to it, that even though the same thing happened over and over again, there was almost the feeling that something different might happen. You know.
Now, your bookishness led you to Lynn Carter, who caused your crisis of faith, right?
Several things were sort of, you know, you look back on these intense experiences, and then they're kind of, the objects that trigger them are sort of have this kind of kitschy quality, and Lynn Carter is such a kitschy sort of writer, and this book, it had this weird sort of semi-psychedelic fantasy cover that when I've ordered a copy of it on Amazon and I saw the cover again, I had all these strange feelings about them. And, you know, like I was kind of looking at it going, oh, it's really a cheesy cover. But then on the same level, I could remember like looking at the cover, the original covers of the Lord of the Rings trilogies, and they had those weird birds on them, and being disturbed by that as a child. And so now I still can't look at them without thinking that they were sort of weird and mysterious and freakish. And this Lynn Carter book had the same cover. And then I remember reading it, and this was really the first work of literary criticism I ever read.
Right. Lynn Carter, for those who don't know, was a sort of a glorified fanboy writer, yeah. of the early mid 70s.
Thank you. He was very enthusiastic, and he seemed like he was a mensch, you know, but he was not that great of a writer. And he loved all of these genres, and then he would write his own versions of them. And he became involved with, I think it was Ballantine Books. They published a line of fantasy after the success of The Lord of the Rings, where he would find like these kind of obscure early pioneers of the genre, like Lord Dunsany or William Morris or whatever, and republish these books in paperback, and then kind of write introductions.
Right.
And that was sort of how I found some of the more grown-up versions of these of the kinds of books that I liked. But this book, I remember I bought it in Paris Books, which was this newsstand in this neighborhood that I would walk to buy candy or comic books or whatever. And I bought this book, and it had this kind of weird cover that was sort of trippy. It was like a face, but it was like a landscape. It was weird. And I bought it in this neighborhood where all these hippies were, and hippies were sort of interesting but scary, and this was sort of interesting but scary. And then I discovered from reading this book, you know, hoping to find out about other writers like C.S. Lewis who were maybe a little more grown up, I suddenly discovered reading this that it was this Christian thing. And I was like, what? And then, like, I thought back and I was like, oh my God, how could I have not have known? I just felt so stupid. And I felt that I had been tricked and betrayed. And part of this was, you know, because I had a particular idea of Christianity that I had gotten from my Catholic upbringing, and it was not congenial to me. I didn't like it. It was one of the things I was trying to get away from. And Narnia was like this eternally sort of refreshing sanctuary from that sort of thing. You know, all the things about mundane life or you know, things that I was supposed to care about that I didn't care about. And to find that it was actually one of those things that I was trying to get away from in disguise was very, very upsetting to me. And in the book, I compare it to one of those Twilight Zone episodes where, like, the characters are trying to get out of a cell, and then they finally get out, and then they realize that they're just in a bigger version of the same cell.
Right. It's interesting. But to me, as a reader of the book, it reminds me of Lewis's own loss of faith in some... I mean, there's an interesting parallel.
It was a complete loss of faith. And I had not actually seen that. It was actually my agent who, when I was writing the proposal, said, you know, well, this is a story about how you lost your faith and how you got it back again.
Right.
It's just not a religious faith. It's a faith in these books and in reading in general.
Well, that's what religion is, right? It's just a faith in stories, storytelling.
Yeah, yeah. And so, well, probably
okay,
not to religious
not
people.
Not to religious people, so.
But yes, you know, it was this, you know, the scales fell from my eyes, and I was horrified, and again, I felt stupid, and blah, blah, blah. And so I didn't actually look at the books for years until I got this writing assignment to write about a book that had changed my life, and I realized if I was going to be really honest about it, it would be this book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And that caused me to kind of go back to it, to see other things than the things that originally enchanted me and the things that originally disillusioned me, and to sort of want to know a little bit more about C.S. Lewis. Like, I realized this person had completely transformed me, and I knew nothing about him. And so that turned into this whole project.
Right. It's interesting because I think that it is that kind of loss of faith and then return to faith in some way or loss of faith in these stories and then return to faith in these stories. And I think that what's interesting is it's the process of learning about Lewis allows you to contextualize the work in a way, you know, in terms of its place in literary history, in terms of Lewis's place in literary history. It's fascinating that it's Philip Pullman who...
Yeah.
A sort of disdain for these books.
He marvels at it. He's
who gives
like,
you the key, you know?
He just is like, I can't. He's going, you know, I never. He's not a Lewis fan, to say the least. And he likes this book. You know, he said, this comes as close. He told me this comes as close to convincing me, you know, but it's just not going to convince me. He's kind of a stubborn guy. And he dislikes being compared to Lewis because he feels that he never, you know, I mean, he only kind of got into complaining about Lewis after he had written His Dark Materials or started. And so he doesn't feel influenced, and people keep thinking that it's kind of a negative influence on him, or that he wrote His Dark Materials as an anti-Lewis thing.
Right, but I think that's the burden of anyone who, you know, the Harry Potter books, there's seven of them, so clearly it must be modeled on Narnia, I mean, whether it is or isn't. But anyone who's writing a kind of series of books for kids that deal with some of this kind of material is inevitably going to be operating in that shadow.
Yeah, but yes, he had this... Well, the thing was that because I didn't want to write a book that was like this fond looking back at the lost innocence of childhood, this idea that he had that is kind of one of the less well-sung ideas in His Dark Materials is that the character Lyra, as a child, as an 11-year-old, she can read this device, and it's like it does kind of divination, you know. It's got a dial. It's the golden compass, but it's almost like it works like a tarot card deck. And she can read it with this unselfconscious grace when she's a child, and then her sort of coming of age, you know, the dawn of puberty and of sexual desire, turns her into a self-conscious person, and she loses that kind of unthinking, graceful ability to read this device. And this prophetic character, who just mostly just comes in to sort of explain what's going on, says to her, you know, you used to be able to read this out of, you know, the unconscious grace. You can't be unconscious anymore. Like, you're not meant to stay that way. But if you work at it your whole life and you continue to work at it, you can come to the same kind of grace and maybe even be better at it through that. And that is sort of the voicing of an idea that he had by way of William Blake, who was a big influence on that, on those three books. The idea that experience is a valuable thing, that it's not simply the destruction of innocence, it has a value in its own right. And that was the sort of, became the guiding principle of this. I thought, well, if I'm sort of stuck in this stage where, like, I don't have the simple, unthinking enchantment of my childhood, and the kind of disillusionment and rejection that I think of as kind of the adolescent stage of my relationship to the books, it doesn't really work for me either. Maybe if I just pursue this further, if I try to learn, try to understand better than I have before, I will come out the other side with some kind of richer or deeper understanding of my relationship to these books and the books themselves. And I did wind up feeling that, partly because I did wind up feeling that there was so much in these books that was not encompassed either in the simple enchantment of childhood or the sort of obvious messages that you know, people point to in there.
Right. I mean, in some ways, it's the reader's, I mean, it's a stand-in for the universal reader's journey, right? You have the sort of, I don't really like the word innocence either, but you have the kind of immersive, sink fully into a book,
unselfconscious
experience of the child. Then you have the reductivism of the sort of adolescent reader who discovers that it's a Christian allegory or whatever you discover about the thing that you you admire, and then you have to pull away from it. And then you have the kind of more adult or mature integration of experience and the revisiting or the reintegration. And that follows throughout the whole the process.
And it is the evolution of love in a way, you know, because when you first love somebody, let's say someone that you've just met, or even say your parents, for example, they seem perfect, and it's this easy, simple, obvious, perfect thing. And then usually there's a period of disillusionment, and maybe you never get past that, and you just reject that relationship. But then there is what we think of as mature love, which is a love that has an awareness of all the things that you don't like about the person, and yet, you know, it's in some ways a larger love, despite that maybe ambivalence, because it's based on what's really there. And so I was aiming for that kind of expand. If you could expand it enough, if you could expand your view of the books enough, you could see things that I didn't see as a child, which is obviously the literary heritage of these books, which has stayed with me my whole life. And so, you know, I write that, you know, when I first read Milton or Dante or Spencer or Shakespeare or, you know, even Tolkien or Jane Austen or Trollope or whatever, I found echoes of Narnia in there, because C.S. Lewis was such a omnivorous reader himself.
Right, I think you refer to him as a magpie writer also, right?
His imagination was a magpie thing, which had a lot to do with his idea about the medievalness of his sensibility, because that was the medieval sensibility. Like, we think of it as being only limited to this kind of churchy Christian thing, but, you know, the medieval kind of creative imagination was, we tried to encompass all of human knowledge, you know, and it tried to fit, like, the, you know, pagan stories and and kind of weird little everyday stuff. You know, like you'd have a book of hours, and it would be like both a devotional book, but it would also be about, you know, threshing the wheat or baking the bread or whatever, you know, all these aspects of everyday life. It was kind of comprehensive in a way that we forget. And so his idea that he was going to put things from Greek mythology and from Teutonic mythology and, you know, kind of E. Nesbitt and William Morris and Austin, you know, because there are these great little characters, like some of the dialogue of the scenes with the characters, the social comedy is so exquisitely done for a kid's book. It's really kind of amazing. That, of course, I had no ability to appreciate that as a child at all. But I read it now, especially after reading, like, say, The Wizard of Oz, where the characters are all so declamatory. Like, you know, they'll get up and go, I'm a scarecrow, and so I'm afraid of fire. You know, and they're constantly saying, I'm a this, and I'm a that. It always seems really American, because everyone's always declaring their identity to everyone else. And instead, there'll just be, like, these little remarks, or, you know, just the bear sucking his paws in Prince Caspian and the dwarf going, you're doing it again, you're doing it again. You know, he just had this ability to capture these really very real relationships in this kind of crazy phantasmagoria of this imaginary land that, you know, I couldn't go, oh, as a kid, I could never go, oh, isn't that great how he does that, or how he, you know, this particular technique where he would use, where there'd be like bits of dialogue that wasn't attributed, it'd be a crowd of people all rushing around and saying different things, and I think of them as dialogue clouds, and none of the lines are attributed, but it sort of captures how when you're in a group of people, like when they're running around the witch's house, finding the little stone creatures and getting Aslan to breathe on them, you know, they're saying, oh, what's down here? Or, oh, I found this. And it's such a great representation of how when you're in a group of people and it's kind of chaotic, but you're doing something together, you feel like a single entity, so that every statement is a statement of the group as well as of the person who's speaking. You know, I just thought, God, that is so great, you know. And I had no ability to see that as a child. So that is a part of the enlarged understanding.
And, I mean, speaking of relationships, one of the things that I think is really interesting about the last part of the book, where you sort of place the work and, frankly, place Lewis in context, is placing him in the context of his own relationships, of a couple of significant, the relationship with his brother, the relationship with Tolkien, which... From the surface, on the surface, it would seem to be that these would have been great collaborators or great kindred spirits, which they were and they weren't. There's an as in sort of your relationship to the book, there's a kind of tension there, a push and pull.
Yeah, well, of course, Tolkien hated Narnia because he was, you know, kind of a purist, and he thought that all those different elements should not be all mixed up together, that
right.
it should
you can't have a sewing machine and a lamppost,
yeah, right? You can't, or marmalade, you know, like the Mrs. Beaver bakes this marmalade roll, and, you know, you think, well, where did that marmalade come from? Because it's not like you can imagine Narnia having surplus, you know, wealth and trading with some warm country where oranges grew, or God forbid, sugar. And so, you know, it doesn't, I mean, I have to say, I don't think Middle Earth is economically plausible either, but he made like some effort.
Now you're getting into dangerous territory.
But he thought about it, you know. He thought, well, you can't. He took tomatoes out of one of the scenes because, like, he imagined that this was like the distant past of Europe, and of course tomatoes are a New World thing, but he still managed to get potatoes in there, I think. Right. And so he kind of blew it on that, but you know, he had this idea that it had to be this comprehensive, it was almost like an OCD kind of thing that Tolkien had, and it had to be pure. He was very, very fixated on purity, and he had this thing about being an Anglo-Saxon and Anglo-Saxon language, and he hated the French because of the Norman conquest. He held it against them, you know, and so he hated the French language because he felt that it had corrupted Anglo-Saxon, and you know, he, and And I find, although I like his books, you know, one of, you know, I finally came to feel like that was the ultimate issue that I had with them, and why they are so sort of humorless, is because there was this kind of weird obsessive control freakish quality to him that made him unable to laugh at himself, and that the kind of the sloppiness that he disliked in Lewis, and that, you know, is a legitimate flaw because the books were kind of written, like, I don't know, he wrote all 7 books in like 2 years, and he was doing a zillion other things at the same time, so he probably write one of those books in like a week or something. It was so productive, a very fluent, you know, facile sort of writer, but he would make a lot of mistakes and he wouldn't fix them because he just didn't care. He was just kind of a whirlwind sort of guy,
and he was telling the story. It was about telling the story.
Yeah, and that just drove Tolkien crazy, you know, it just really bugged him. And he was trying to sort of continue to believe in this friendship because Lewis just believed in him so much. And he was kind of holding on to that. And then there was this other friend that came along who there was this, you know, he was displaced by. And it was a very bumpy relationship that ultimately ended in a kind of estrangement. Partly because I think they had those two different personality types. And I ultimately wound up feeling, I mean, there's this kind of tendency in the world of people who care about these books to sort of hold Tolkien up as some kind of intellectual zenith, you know. And I, to me, he is a less literary writer than Lewis.
It's interesting because I, you know, he's, to me, I mean, Lewis is sloppier and it's more of a kind of haphazard kind of patchwork cottage, let's say, and Tolkien is this elaborately constructed edifice, but Lewis is warm, and I mean, I'm not a fan of the Tolkien books. I never was, and in fact, my, you know, as I was saying, I think I was saying to you before, one of my favorite lines in this book is when they were part of a group called the Inklings, and they would read work to the group, and at the beginning, Tolkien brought something in to read, and as he started reading, one of the members of the group said, "Not another fucking elf." You know, that's sort of always been my reaction to Tolkien, too.
He would be reading the Silmarillion at this point, which is a lot of these kind of noble elves coming on scenes and looking upon them with sorrow. That was even more serious than The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
You know, I don't want to just totally rag on Tolkien because I do love Tolkien, but he is less congenial to me than Lewis, and I feel like Tolkien is kind of a weird dead end in a certain way. All the attachments that I formed in Lewis would lead me to other books and other types of writing. Like, for me, it's airier. It opens up into, even though it's not this huge creation, it's because every little kind of branch or root that goes out of it goes out into, like, the larger world of literature, as opposed to just back into itself. And so, you know, I write in the book that the first time I read The Faerie Queen, which I know you're not a fan of that, but but is one of my favorite books of all time, I was just like, oh, I know this. You know, it's so, you know, the Narnia sort of saturated in that, but also, as I mentioned before, Dante or Milton or Shakespeare or even the realistic, you know, social comic novels of the 19th century, you know, it's all, I knew it all, I had met it all before in Lewis, and that's, that it was all just home to me.
And well, and I think that's the key point in some ways, both from my reading of your book and my reading of Lewis, both as a child and my later reading of it to my kids, is that it is, I mean, it's not only open enough to lead you to the other things that Lewis brought in there, it's also open enough to lead you back into it and to find other things there so that you can find, so that, you know, even you as a reader who appreciated it for one thing as a child and then was an apostate, let's say, to use that language for a while, and that you were able to find a way back to it and find a kind of expansiveness in it that allowed you to, as you say, reach a kind of mature relationship with it where you could encompass the things that you found problematic.
Partly because it is really open. It's like an open system that just kind of expands outwards, as opposed to this completely encased thing that the Tolkien model is. And but yet, you know, people don't take Narnia that seriously because it is more kind of like it doesn't really make any sense as an imaginary world. It's really like an allegorical space, but people don't really know how to read allegory anymore, so they don't have any respect for it. Like, to say something is an allegory is an expression of contempt to the modernist, postmodernist, postmodernist reader. You know, it's supposed to be a lesser literary form. And one of the great things about researching this book was reading The Allegory of Love, which was Lewis's first great, and some people think, I know Adam Gopnik thinks it's really his best book, the best book he wrote, which is a study of medieval allegory. And it made his reputation as a scholar. It's a great book. And it's a great book about a bunch of literary works, mostly poems, that you're never going to want to read. You know, I mean, he just gives these things so much more. I mean, he is that kind of critic where the work becomes more. Like, I have read some of the things that he writes about, and just, oh God, it was such a chore. And you know, he just makes you think that they're filled with possibility. You know, like, he's a wonderful, incredibly generous critic in that way. And you know, and just the idea, one of the things that he wrote about allegory was that there's a scene in The Romance of the Rose, which is this French allegory that is one of the sort of main, you know, pinnacles of the form. And it's it describes this young man's attempt to woo this woman, which according to the rules of chivalry. And there's a scene where he is looking into a fountain, a sparkling fountain, and it's described very beautifully. And Lewis writes, you're meant to understand that this is the first time he's looking into his mistress's eyes. And he said, but to sort of say that that's what this means and that's all that it means, like he's not really looking into a fountain, he's looking into his mistress's eyes, is to completely miss the knack of reading an allegory. When you read an allegory, you're meant to see that, when you read that, you're meant to see that he's looking into his mistress's eyes and he's looking at a fountain. The mistress's eyes are beautiful. The fountain is beautiful. You're supposed to experience both at the same time. You're in the same way that you understand that when he meets a character called shame, or a character called courtesy, or, you know, a character called fear, or something like that. These are both sort of characters, and they are also parts of the personality of the mistress. He said her personality is distributed over personifications, that the garden where all this is taking place is her mind, and he is interacting with all these different parts of her personality because that is how allegory is understood. But you're also understanding that he's speaking to people in a garden, and we have kind of lost the ability to read in that way, to see two things at the same time. And that's why allegory seems really crude to us, instead of kind of this. I mean, the way he writes it, you know, it's just like this. You're just ravished by the beauty of this because you're experiencing two kinds of beauty at the same time: the eyes of the mistress and the sparkling fountain. I can't remember how I got down.
Well, I mean,
but that's
the sort of the argument you're making in regard to the way Narnia works, also.
Yes, because you.
Yeah, we bring it back to the Narnia.
Yes. You see that, you know, is the only meaningful thing about Aslan that he's supposed to be Jesus, or is the fact that he's a lion and he's big? You know, what you remember about him, I remember about him as a child, is not that he died and was reborn, but the fact that he was big and warm and furry and his breath smelled good, and, you know, and he was so kind. And so, you know, these things were not, you know, it had nothing to do with my understanding of what Jesus was. And so, you know, there's the kind of a physicality to that description of that God, basically, that is not was not really part of the Christianity that I was raised in. You're not supposed to go and, like, hug Jesus or, you know, I mean, it's so, the sensuality in the description of Lucy and Susan, like, sort of burying their face in his fur and then rolling around and playing with him the way you would with a great big dog is just, it's too weird to think about doing that with Jesus because he's a man. And that's an important difference, you know?
And that seems like a perfect place to turn it over to the audience. So we have, we have a microphone? We have two microphones. So raise your hands and we will call on you.
Well, like you, I stumbled upon the Narnia books when I was around 8 years old. My dad used to drop me off at the library on Saturday afternoons, and I discovered the whole fantasy section and the kids section there. So I read them, and also I had no idea about the symbolism. And I also thought it was pronounced Narnia, and it wasn't until I was like in my 20s that I realized I'd been pronouncing it wrong. But anyway, around the age 19... I stumbled across another couple of his fiction books, and I don't know if they were meant for young adults or adults, but they were sort of science fiction, and I can't even remember the name of them now. Yeah. But
they were called the Space Trilogy,
and I was really disappointed in them. I felt like I was sort of being hit over the head for him to make his points, and there was like a mad scientist and a trip in a spaceship, and it was not at all as elegantly written as the Narnia books were. Can you say something about those?
Well, I like the first book of that trilogy, partly because a lot of it is set on another planet, and one of the things I like about Lewis is the sensuality of his writing, and there was such an effort to understand the totally different physicality of these creatures. So I like that one for that. You know, I didn't read them in my youth, so I wasn't, you know, I kind of knew what I was getting into. The second one suffered from his tendency to kind of work himself up into this kind of, to make the climax this kind of ever-unfolding sort of Neoplatonic explosion, you know? It's like some, like the metaphysical version of some action movie where the just explosions keep getting bigger and bigger until finally I just felt like I couldn't even understand what he was trying to say. And this was the influence of Charles Williams, who was a novelist who became a friend of his while he was writing those books. And and actually Tolkien thought that he didn't like that element. He thought Williams was a bad influence on Lewis, partly for that reason. It was this attempt to turn this crazy Neoplatonic ecstasy into a work of fiction, and I don't think it's very effective. But he did write a book called "The Till We Have Faces," which I think it's an adult fiction, and it has some of that problem at the end, but much less of it. And I would recommend it. It's based on the Cupid and Psyche myth, and it's set, I got the impression, is sort of like ancient, in the part of the world, the Asia Minor that we would call Turkey, and I quite like that book, so I would recommend that. Till We Have Faces.
What do you think about John Goldthwait's theory that Lewis was really a closet Manichaean?
You know, it's not. This is John Goldthwait. You've read that book. It's a book called The Natural History of Childhood. And Phil Pullman actually told me about this book, which I had never heard of before. And I don't really know anything about this guy who wrote it. But it's kind of a great book, but it's also slightly cracked. Like, the longest chapter is this, like, diatribe about Alice in Wonderland and how it's just this work of total rage and class hatred, and it's astonishing because, you know, you just he has a point, but it's a little out of control. And he's a sort of a strange writer to be accusing like another writer of not, of letting his anger just totally run away with him because he's such an angry writer. But he's actually a really talented writer. I had a whole like bit on Gnosticism in my book that I wound up cutting because I thought, you know, I could try for the rest of my life and I am not going to understand Gnosticism. Or at least not well enough to really answer that question. I mean, in some ways, he seems sort of Manichaean in the belief that a simple way to explain this would be that the Orthodox Christian belief is that creation is good, and that sin is the result of a kind of a turning away from God, but it's not something that's inherent in the material universe. And the Manichaean idea, and I'm probably totally butchering this, is that that the material universe is created by this sort of almost like a false sub-god, a demiurge, and that our the human soul is like a piece of the true God that's sort of trapped in this material world. And it's basically the difference between the idea that the material world is inherently fallen or bad. And Tolkien, I think, came pretty close to believing this. I mean, he just thought that this world was just, you know, just a loss. You know, he was so gloomy that he approached the Manichaean heresy. I think he actually comes closer to it than Lewis did, especially temperamentally. I mean, Lewis was actually mostly a pretty happy guy, and the sort of carnality of his writing, I think, testifies to his general liking of the material world. There were certain things he was really ambivalent about, particularly sexuality, but Pullman has accused him of thinking of the world or of life as sort of inferior to heaven or God. But I don't really see that in his work as much, you know. And I think Goldthwaite has a lot of other things that bother him, some of which are legitimate and some of which are really overblown. And I think that his definition of sort of Christian orthodoxy is deliberate. He makes it deliberately narrow so that Lewis won't fit in it. And I don't actually think that Lewis kind of, you know, but I'm not a theologian, so I can't be authoritative about that.
I just want to say I really relate to your story of your ongoing love affair with Narnia. I'm an English teacher now, and I was an English major, and a similar journey. I had started out just loving it as a kid, and then reflecting it, it's kind of similar to you. I came back to it then, 17 or 18, and the different take on it then was that I still loved it, and I took it instead as a window into religion. It was like, oh, now I'm going to read The Problem of Pain. I'm going to read The Great Divorce. I'm going to read That Hideous Strength. I'm going to read all these things. You know, and I got into it for a while, and then eventually I discovered that no, in fact, what I had loved was something similar to what you described. It wasn't the religion. It wasn't this thing, his agenda. It was actually just that, you know, unutterable essence, whatever that is, you know,
in
there.
The imaginative flavor of it.
Right, right. And so, you know, now I'm, you know, I've been teaching English for a while. I'm applying to MFA programs. I tell myself, you know, I do love Salinger and Melville and, you know, David Foster Wallace and, you know, Franz and all these people we're supposed to like. But at some level, I do like them, I do. But at some level, I really relate still to what you said about how you're still, I'm still chasing Lewis, and I'm still chasing Baum, and I'm still chasing Tolkien, I'm still chasing Out of the Silent Planet at some level. But, you know, the college creative writing teacher in freshman year who kind of like sneered at the idea that I was influenced by Perelandra when I should have been influenced by Dubliners, you know, that still just stuck with me, and I couldn't quite shake it. So my question then for you is, you said that you were chasing that experience and you looked for books that would give you something like that. And I was wondering, as an adult reader, you know, there's some people who say Jonathan Carroll does it. There's some people who say certain writers can give that kind of joy or almost supernatural reading experience to adult readers. Are there any books that have come close to recapturing that for you as an adult?
Well, I think the writer who, I love this question. I think the writer who, while having a totally different flavor of his own, nevertheless kind of comes close to doing this having that particular, almost, you know, in a way, allegorical quality of like what you're describing. The action of the novel is really all happening in the psyche of a single person, is Haruki Murakami, the Japanese novelist. And he, since David Foster Wallace died, is now my favorite living writer. And so, you know, they're different, you know, there are different things. You know, the writer Susanna Clarke, who wrote Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, in some ways satisfies some of that craving, and in some ways, you know, maybe Neil Gaiman does, but probably Murakami comes closest because it's so completely distinctive to him, you know, that I feel though that I'm sort of in that a similar sort of mode when I'm reading him.
The children are, their surname is Pevensey. Is that right?
Pevensey, yeah. The original four siblings, yeah.
Yes. And that's not a common name. It's I've not heard it anywhere except one other place. Recently rereading the Just So stories of Kipling, and he has this boy and girl who wander around in the summertime and run across a little dwarf who really fills them in on history.
I think you're thinking of, aren't you thinking of Puck of Pook
that's
Sale?
That's right. That's not just that's a book.
Yeah, he loved that book. Yeah,
and that they lived in Pevensey.
Yeah,
you think that's coincidental?
Well, actually, Puck, when he's talking to the brother and sister in that book, calls them son of Adam and daughter of Eve, which are what Pevensey children are called in *The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe*. But Pevensey is a name that occurs in Wales. I mean, I know that there are Welsh people with that name. So, even though it doesn't seem Welsh to me, but yes, he was definitely influenced by. He loved that book.
What you said about being able to be immersed in Narnia as opposed to being left rather cold by books like Heidi or Little Women, it really reminds me of an article I read by Lois McMaster Bujold, who of course is a fabulous science fiction and fantasy writer, and she rather sweepingly divides all readers of fiction into two types. Type A readers who read books that really reflect their own reality, their own thoughts and feelings, and readers who want anything but that. They don't want reality, they want to escape. They want a whole new world, type B readers. And I was wondering, does that resonate at all, what you think?
Well, I think there's, I have this friend, and we were discussing a similar issue about childhood reading, and I said, well, you know, there's basically Little Women readers and Phantom Tollbooth readers. And, and you know, in childhood. And while I did read, say, Little House on the Prairie, which to me was more in the Little Women category, and liked it, you know, I didn't love it. And I tended to like more of an adventure story. But I have to say, as an adult, I like both kinds, you know. I still don't like Little Women. but, you know, I do like Alice Munro. And so, you know, to me, I feel like part of my maturing process is my ability to understand the merits of that kind of book. I mean, I don't think that Little Women is that good of a book. I'm sorry. But the characters are so sort of saccharine. And that was sort of my issue with all of these books that were sort of pushed on me, was the kind of the children who were too good and who were too sort of obedient, or I don't know. It just, you know, I think that was it to a certain degree, and that was the books that were given to me that were about those relationships tended to have this kind of saccharine quality, and that maybe if I were reading different kinds of you know, if I were growing up now and there were, you know, the kids' books now are tend to have to be a little bit more realistic, maybe I wouldn't have felt that way. I mean, I tend to think I still would have because I was very, you know, I really wanted to sort of grow up and get out there and do stuff. And I wasn't really that focused on, you know, domestic relationships. And so so probably I still would have had that preference, but I wouldn't have attached it so much to this kind of sugary thing, which I associated it with. And as a grown-up, I now realize that there's no reason why it has to be sugary and saccharine. But I still, I think I still will always slightly have that preference for a more sort of expansive story.
We've got time for one more. So the woman up in the back has had her hand up for a while.
I know this is a bleeding obvious question, but Lewis Carroll, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, Pullman, Susanna Clarke all spent time in the same city and wrote about it. Is there something particular about Oxford that you've figured out since you've been so immersed in this world?
I'm sorry, I have to correct you. Susanna Clarke, Cambridge.
Nope, I was a contemporary. We were at the same
Really?
University.
She lives in Cambridge now.
Yes, she was at St. Hilda's, uh-huh. or St. Hugh's, one or the other.
Okay. Well, I you know, I don't know. I did ask Philip Pullman about that, and he had some vague theories, but you know, he wasn't a Don, so you know, he has a definitely much more sort of scrappy populist sense of Oxford than Lewis or Tolkien had. I would say just in general that there is something about British writers that seems to lend itself to these sort of imaginary worlds that you can enter into, because beyond just the writers that you've listed, I think of
Cambridge. Hmm? Cambridge.
Yeah. I think that but if you look at, like, say, P.G. Wodehouse or Arthur Conan Doyle, they create these kind of little kind of bubble worlds that you can sort of enter into and kind of hang out in imaginatively, and the British do seem to have a knack for that. Like, there are not as many, they seem to have more of a knack for it than any other nationality I could think of.
And Dr. Seuss is American and was at Oxford.
I know, but I don't think of Dr. Seuss as that you know, he, you know, that kind of writer. Like you know, the kind of, like, the way that one of this writer that I once worked with, it was part of some kind of online discussion where everyone made up P.G. Wodehouse characters and pretended to be them and had these conversations. I was like, this is so wacky. But you can sort of see it if you read Wodehouse. You know, you can imagine, like, inventing more fiancés for Bertie Wooster to run away from.
Well, thank you, Laura. Pleasure. Laura Miller.
Thanks, David.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.